Time is 3:40. We do not have a quorum to conduct, to move anything. However, we can have discussion, and we do have some people online and who have flown around the state to get here today. So we'll hear testimony from them. With us are Senator Huggins, Senator Wagner, and myself, Wilikowski. And the first order of business will be Senate Bill 220. We have two amendments which are being proposed for this bill, and again, we'll have these bills up before us for discussion purposes only. The first one is to create a new loan program within the Department of Commerce and business interested in alternative energy and energy efficiency. And at this time, I'd like to call Mike Pawlowski. Greg, why don't you come on up? Greg Winninger forward. And for the members, the proposed amendment is /K11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
For the record, Greg Winninger, Director of the Division of Investments.
Thank you, Mr. Winninger. Why don't you tell us specifically about this amendment, and please go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Basically the amendment makes two fundamental changes to the original bill. It adds conservation improvements as an eligible purpose, along with alternative energy systems, which was in the original bill. The other major change is that the bill now targets commercial buildings, as residential structures are eligible for similar type of loans through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
And let me just reflect that Senator Stedman is here. Thank you, Senator. Please go ahead.
Okay. So basically those are kind of the two major changes from the original bill. The thinking on the commercial buildings was that to avoid duplication, that HFC already has a program for residential type loans. So this bill now would be structured to target commercial buildings that are owned by Alaska residents. So those are the two major changes. There was a slight change made in the loan limits from $30,000 to $50,000, and this would allow borrowers to not only put in an energy system but also take advantage of loans for conservation type things. So the limit was slightly raised as well. And those are the major changes, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you, Mr. Winninger. Any questions from the members? Okay, Mike, do you want to come up, and we'll have Mike walk us through the bill, and then if you could just stay right there, and we may have questions
Thank you, Mr.
Pawlowski.
For the record, this is Mike Pawlowski, aide to Senator McGuire. And I think Greg did a great job of explaining what the purpose of the amendment is, and that was to overcome the duplication in Section 17 through 21 of the K version of SB 220. Since there was an AHFC program that related to that, this now deals with what was missing in the bill, which was a fund or mechanism to get out to the commercial sector. And this would renew an old alternative energy revolving loan fund, limited to commercial, and make it for conservation improvements as well. And I'd point out just one thing. I'm not sure if Greg mentioned this, and that's in Section 21 on page 2, lines 22 through 28. And this is a break from the... Yes, the loan may not exceed $50,000, but once you go over $30,000, it asks that you've worked with your financial institution as a commercial entity, and they have to present a turndown letter to the department. And this has been done in other programs, and it's to maintain where the state is supplementing rather than competing with the regular commercial loan sector. Mr. Chairman, I think that's the amendment.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? And I'll just say I was very, very happy to see the definition of energy conservation improvement. I know that was a big question in a previous bill that we had, and so I'm glad there's been some attempt to define that. And we have Senator Stevens here as well. Any questions? Senator Stevens, we're on an Amendment K-11 to Senate Bill 220.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll set this amendment aside. Next up, we have an amendment that is being proposed by Senator Huggins, And I'll ask Sharon Long to step up and explain the amendment. Welcome to the committee, Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman Wilikowski, members of the committee. My name is Sharon Long. I'm legislative aide to Senator Huggins. This amendment strives to delete prohibitions in current Alaska statutes, which prevent us from considering nuclear projects as part of this great smorgasbord of energy alternatives that we have in the state. So the first one, you have a short amendment, one pager. Do you see that? It's unnumbered. I didn't know if you were going to number it.
That's the one. One page just changes one.
It changes one word. On page two of version K, it inserts the word nuclear in the uncodified portion of the bill. It's line 24, right after the word including. Okay. And then on to this amendment, which is labeled K.10 to SB 220.
Okay.
If you go to page one, line five of the bill, that simply aligns the title of the bill with the changes that are made later in the bill. Go to page three in the bill, line 18. It's a simple renumbering. More substantively, down to line 20 on page three, insert new bill section four. This amendment speaks to federal licensing and permits. Chapter 45020 only speaks to federal aspects of atomic energy, and it includes special nuclear material facility and byproduct material facility in order to cover more projects or activities in this section for which a license or permit may be needed from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It adds right there on page three, it would add a new section 4, 5, 6, and 7. And section 5 of the amendment.
So you're on the amendment?
I'm on the amendment,
section 5. Okay.
Yeah.
Can I back you up 1 second on the page 1 where you're changing section 4? And it looks like line 16.
You're on page 1 of the amendment.
Page 1 of the amendment, right. A person may not manufacture, construct, produce, transfer, acquire, or possess a special nuclear material, byproduct material. Special nuclear material facility, byproduct material facility. So we're expanding what a person cannot produce.
Now that is, if the commission requires a license or permit to be obtained by persons proposing to engage in these activities. So, and we're going to repeal the prohibitions. Brian Kane is on standing by to speak to why those specific words are used.
Brian, are you there? Do we have Brian Kane on the line?
Mr. Chair, I'm here. This is Brian Kane.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I had a question on the amendment K-10. Page 1, lines 16 through 18. Can you just explain to me what you're attempting to do there?
Mr. Chairman, what we're attempting to do is these sections 1845 have a lot of terms that are kind of were previously just used mismatched throughout. Sometimes it would have a full phrase with facility, sometimes facility wasn't there. And so the goal here, I believe, was to try and be sure that we covered every possibility that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission could cover, because as it stood, it was just special nuclear material and byproduct material. So just by adding facility there, it puts in the possibility of if there is some sort of a special nuclear facility or byproduct material facility that goes in connection with the actual material, and a license is needed from the federal government to put together or to build that type of facility, then a person has to obtain that permit from the federal government before they can take any further steps.
And Brian, as I was reading through the amendment and doing a little research on this, I became very curious about what the interplay is between federal regulation and state regulation of nuclear facilities, nuclear energy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, as best I've seen so far, I've done some reading on the Atomic Energy Act, and basically the federal government has a pretty long and complex list of permits and applications you have to run through to even start the process of putting together a nuclear facility or producing any kind of nuclear energy. And basically the Atomic Energy Act preempts pretty much everything that a state could do, with the exception of economic regulation, which is a little bit later on in this amendment. But mainly it's you have to fulfill all their obligations first, and then once you've fulfilled everything that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has lined up, then you would proceed to these different state portions of different permits you would need, either from the municipality or from the designation of land by the legislature.
And just out of curiosity, what you're changing in Section 4, it would seem to me that you probably couldn't own a special nuclear material facility without getting permission from the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, I would think, right?
Mr. Chairman, I would imagine so, and this is just making that just clear, adding that to the list of things that the federal permit is required, so it's explicitly written in statute.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for Mr. Kane? Brian, could you hold on? We're still going through the amendment, and we may have some other questions for you. Thanks, Sharon.
And Chairman Wilkowski, I did find out today that the state has no regulations and no permit requirements right now. They have nothing on the books. The NERC, the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Commission, does have a stepwise process where first you have to have a licensed unit, a nuclear power unit, and so far there are no small licensed ones. We're not to the Ford, manufacturing aspect of this yet, where they're just some out there on the shelf that you can buy. You have to get a special license for whatever Westinghouse or GE nuclear power unit you want to use. So, and then you have to get an early site permit, and there's a lot of field work that has to be done about seismology and geology and flora and fauna and water and air. And so there's an extensive permit process with NERC, but nothing so far with the state.
And Ms. Long, in your research, have you found that most states have a fairly complex set of regulations on top of the federal regulations, or do they most rely on the federal regulations? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't know what the other states are doing.
Do you have any sense, Brian?
Mr. Chairman, I have not looked into any other states, so I can't answer that question.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm doing some further research.
So Section 5, back on the amendment. Section 5 speaks to the state licensing permits and requirements, and it adds nuclear utilization facility to conform with other definitions. Right now they don't have much of a body of statute on it, though. Section 6 of the amendment amends 1845-025 to state that when the legislature designates by law the land in the state on which a nuclear utilization facility may be located, it must act only in the interest of regulating the economics of nuclear energy. And this is based on a series of court cases, which Brian can explain if you're interested. So that's why that has to be in there. Section 7 of the amendment deletes a line that states that a permit may not be issued unless approved by the governor, leaving only a requirement for approval by the Department of Environmental Conservation and a municipality. So this retains local approval for a project that might be in any particular area, but removes the governor's part in that. Of course, any project would still be dealing with NERC, DEC, probably AEA, and a local political subdivision. Section 15, if the amendment, go to page 7 of your bill.
Yes, Senator Huggins.
Chair, just for clarification, Section 7 allows some degree of local control. I mean, that's...
Yes. That was the purpose in leaving that in there. It was surmised by the people I talked to that it would probably be a local political subdivision that would be bringing this kind of project forward to the state.
Can I just pause right there for a second, Sharon? And so a permit, okay, so the permit has to go through the Department of Environmental Conservation and also the municipality with jurisdiction over the proposed facility. So if it was in Anchorage, let's say, it would have to go through the Anchorage
Assembly
or, okay. What if it's in an area that is, does not have a local government?
I discussed that with Brian, and I don't know if he's had any further thoughts on it, but the sense was that then they would be dealing with NERC and the DEC.
Okay. And then if... But
it wouldn't
any area would have to deal with the NERC?
Yes, they would have to deal with the NERC and DEC. So if it was a village corporation, say, or a community in the unorganized borough, then they would just be going directly to the state.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So where are we? We're on Section 15, the amendment. So Section 15 goes on page 7, line 28 of your bill. It adds a new Section 15. It amends the definition of power project to delete the exclusion of nuclear energy from the definition in relation to statewide energy programs. Section 22 of the amendment is... Page 12, line 2 of the bill. It amends the definition of power project or project to delete the exclusion of nuclear energy in relation to the Alaska Energy Authority. And this will allow the Energy Authority to consider power projects that depend on a thermal, mechanical, or electrical energy system that depends on nuclear power. Right now, they can't consider projects that depend on nuclear power. Section 27, this is another removing the exclusion of nuclear fuel. And then finally in the end, page 4 of your amendment, line 11. This eliminates the prohibition of transporting nuclear waste material from our statutes.
Sharon, could I just stop right there? And could you explain that a little bit?
As I understand it now, there's a prohibition in the state of Alaska from transporting nuclear waste material, and this would eliminate that, because if you had a nuclear power project, the fuel cycle generates nuclear waste, and we'd have to be able to transport it legally in the state. And I need to find out how the nuclear medicine departments in the state deal with that, because you know we do have use of nuclear material in the state, and so we'll find out how that is allowed. Brian, can you add anything to that?
I can. Mr. Chairman, the 027 actually has a Part A and a Part B, and Part B actually has an exclusion for radioactive materials used in medicine, education, or scientific research as an exception to the high-level nuclear waste material that can be transported.
Okay, so when we were removing the provision against the transfer of nuclear material, so who would be able to transfer nuclear material under this, the way you have this proposed on page 4? Would anybody be able to do that? Would you have to be regulated by the RCA, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? How would that work under the way this is written?
Mr. Chair, it's the state law would be, at least if you delete this, it would be silent to that situation. This just is a complete prohibition against it, and so we are getting rid of the prohibition. If we wanted to further look into how you go about transporting it or adding it somewhere else, we could do that. And I'm not sure if they're what the federal guidelines are for transporting, but I believe I saw something in the Atomic Energy Act or under the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that did make some reference to transportation of nuclear materials.
Yeah, I think that'd be important to try to figure out what the federal regs are and if we need to enact some other state law or regulation to control that. Obviously, we want to have some controls on who transfers that. But okay, any other questions? Yeah, please go ahead, Sharon.
That's it. That's the end of the amendment. The remaining sections are renumbering.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the things that we were attempting to do here, there's been a long, ongoing discussion and effort to look at a small nuclear module, if you will, in Galena. Mm-hmm. But every time you get that discussion halfway down the road, suddenly you find it was prohibited, can't do it. And this is essentially to relieve the prohibition, number one. Number two, put the skeletal structure for a process. Mm-hmm. And number three, in my estimation, will require extensive regulations, which will have to be put in place by DEC and other appropriate agencies. But it develops a straw man which we can build upon. And, you know, and just this is my own personal thoughts on it. If the French have about 70% of their power from nukes, and the Japanese, I think, are number two internationally, we ought to at least have a system that allows us to have that conversation in some reality if it comes to fruition. So
I agree. I think it's certainly a conversation that's worth having. And if we can figure out a way that we can do it safely and cost effectively, it certainly is a conversation worth having. Do you have any sense, Sharon, on cost of building a nuclear plant?
I mean, no idea. Okay. Depends on the how many megawatts you want to put out. I have no idea.
Okay.
I know that Westinghouse and Toshiba have a small unit that they want to get licensed that would be appropriate, say, for the Galena project, and seem to be within reach. So, and also, as to regulating anything but economics, I guess because of the court cases, that's about all we have control over when we're approving one of these things, that NERC has control over health and safety issues.
So Brian or Sharon, whoever can answer this, so for instance, setting rates on a nuclear power plant, would that be done by the RCA or is that done by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Do you know, Brian?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's something that the RCA could potentially control. I know that the main thrust of the, at least the couple of cases I'm familiar with in the area, are that the federal law, their rules on the health and safety aspects are the actual rule, and you can't do anything different than what their rule is. Whereas anything to do with the economics, at least according to the court cases, has stood. So I'm not 100% sure that how it would actually fall when the regulating comes, but I believe there's just the basic rules on permitting and getting your facility up and running and in that respect. And I think the state would possibly have control over any other, rates or anything of that sort.
We also have Sarah Fisher Goad online from the Alaska Energy Authority. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Do you have any comments? Does the Alaska Energy Authority have any comments on this amendment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, for the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad with the Alaska Energy Authority. We do not have any comments with respect to this amendment. We are here to answer questions how they pertain to either the Power Project Fund or the AEA statutes.
Do you want to give us a real quick overview of the relation with the AEA statutes or the Power Project Fund?
Certainly. The way I read this amendment, Mr. Chairman, is that if this amendment were to be incorporated into Senate Bill 220, the Power Project Fund would be an eligible financing vehicle for a nuclear project. And then with respect to AS 4483 change, that would allow, as a definition of power project, to include a nuclear project. The one caveat I will mention on that is there are other statutory changes to AEA that does not allow us to own new projects. So if there was a desire for AEA to own a future project, be it any project, whether it be hydro or a nuclear project or any other generation or transmission project, we would need other statutes changed to allow us to do that. So that does not this doesn't allow us to own something new.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Yes, Senator Huggins.
Quick questions. Sarah, Charlie Huggins here, Wasilla. It appears to me that under AEA's authority and responsibility that you would want reasonable portfolio of energy projects and capabilities in which to choose from, and not that nuclear should be number one or number 29, but it would just be one of the items given some concept, some funding that would be part of a choice moving forward. Because, I mean, geothermal has not been a part of our conversation recently, until recently. The same thing with tidal and wave, and we've made some progress on wind, and now we're sitting here talking about nuclear. But would you agree that there's not a difficulty with having it as part of a portfolio?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I guess my perspective on that is that you have an amendment before you that would allow us to consider nuclear. Right now, we don't have a position with respect to whether that should be included or not. However, if this amendment shall pass, we would consider nuclear projects again, through either the Power Project Fund or if there were other programs that would require us to administer a grant or consider a future project. So I guess that is a policy call that I'm not prepared to answer with respect to whether it should be included or not. We are just trying to let you know and let the committee know with respect to this amendment how we would consider it if it was included. We had on, I think there was a House bill last year that was considered, and I think there is a fiscal note that was made available that, you know, right now we don't have any nuclear projects that we would be considering. If there were projects of this nature that AEA would have to be involved in and be working with potential owners or grantees, for example, we would need some additional costs, but right now, since there are none, we wouldn't have any additional costs to our programs.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. Other questions for Sarah? Okay, yeah, Sharon.
Senator Wilkowski, asked your question about RCA regulation. Mike Pulaski of Senator McGuire's staff just passed me a note saying that Title 42, which is Public Utilities and Carriers, 4205990 does say that RCA would regulate nuclear rates.
And we have a few people online from the RCA, and I was just going to ask them if they had any comments. I think we've got Rich Gazaway, Bob Pickett, and James Keen online. Any comments on this amendment?
Chairman Wilkowski, this is Bob Pickett, Chairman of the RCA. I actually have Stuart Gehring from the Attorney General's office here, too. Stuart, are you frantically going to the appropriate section? And James Keen is here also, and Rich Gazaway, our advisory section chief.
Any comments on this? Just there for questions?
Yes, I believe it's fair. Rich, will you?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm trying to figure out what section of 4205-990 Mr. Pulaski references when he says we would regulate the nuclear facility.
He's coming to the table right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Mike Pulaski, aide to Senator McGuire. My answer was more in the question of if nuclear was selling electricity under 4205-990, a utility that serves one or more customers and makes more than $50,000 a year is regulated by the RCA. So presuming that a nuclear facility sold more than $50,000 in electricity a year, it would be rate regulated by the RCA.
Stuart is about to address that. Yes, this is Stuart Gehring. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the RCA, and I would agree with that assessment that to the extent that the nuclear facility is generating and providing electric power for compensation, it would be within the definition of a public utility. Specifically, we're looking at AS 4205-994A, which provides that every entity that owns, operates, manages, or controls any plant, pipeline, or system for furnishing by generation, transmission, or distribution electrical service to the public for compensation. So it doesn't specifically mention nuclear. Certainly electrons are electrons. If it's electrical power generation that's being provided to the public for compensation, it's going to meet that definition.
And
answer your question, Chairman Wilikowski?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And let me just throw this general question out. Do you see any do you have any concerns over us needing to enact any other legislation should we adopt this amendment or an amendment that allows for nuclear energy production in Alaska?
I don't think we have specifically analyzed this amendment to date. We can certainly take a look at it and see if there's anything that perhaps we should be thinking of. At this moment, I would say probably not, but I would like the ability to really look at it.
Yeah, if you could do that in the next few days, that'd be great, preferably by Wednesday or Thursday, and just get back to Michelle in my office as to whether or not you have any amendments or suggestions, comments, questions. That'd be very helpful for us. Any other questions for the RCA? Okay, seeing none, thank you for proposing this. Okay, we're going to set this amendment aside, and thank you, Senator Huggins, for proposing this and bringing this up. It's a good conversation to have. Okay, we have one other bill before us, and that...
Chairman, before you go...
Yes,
there,
Senator Wagner.
I'm going to... we've gotten some more information. I'm going to withdraw my amendment, if that's all right, to K6.
Okay.
At this time, and we'll either develop it into a committee bill so we can do it in committee, or else wait till next year.
Fair enough. K6 is withdrawn. Okay. Next up, we have Senate Bill 277 by the Senate Energy Committee. And we have Mike Pulaski here from Senator McGuire's office to talk about that bill. Put yourself on the record and give us an overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Mike Pulaski, aide to Senator Lisa McGuire. And interestingly enough, this Senate Bill 277 addresses the section of law that we were just talking about with the RCA, and that is in the definition of a public utility. The definition within statute is relatively circular. The definition of public, the definition of utility refers to public, which then refers to utility, which refers back to public. So, needless to say, within the state of Alaska, there's a bit of confusion out there about what the appropriate role of independent power producers are. Traditionally, we've had large locally owned cooperatives or municipally owned utilities serving in a regulated marketplace. What Senator McGuire, through her research, has discovered is that the rate of penetration of renewable energy sources within regulated and unregulated markets is fundamentally different. And there's information in your packet about competitive electricity markets. It is a study that speaks to a little bit of that problem, and the authors suggest that the difference in risk profile of a regulated monopolistic utility versus an investor is fundamentally different on the way they approach projects. What Senate Bill 277 attempts to do is exempt independent power producers that generate entirely from renewable energy sources
and then sell to a regulated utility from the regulations that are explicitly in statute now. The theory being that the layer of protection available to the consumer comes at the regulated utility level. But in the way we are familiar with gas contracts in Cook Inlet, where the producer of gas is not regulated, but the contract for gas is regulated, looking at that type of model for renewable power in Alaska, we believe will encourage the development of renewable energy in Alaska, remove some of what could be considered duplicative regulation in statute, and open the door for private investment in the sector so that we can drive really meeting that 50% renewable energy goal by 2020. Mr. Chairman, the bill is actually fairly simple and straightforward, and I'll walk through it very quickly. Section 1 and Section 2, you'll see that on page 1, line 10, the OR subsection Q is inserted there, and you'll see the same thing on page 2, line 1. This is conforming language to the exemption that's actually prepared in Section 3, and this is the primary exemption. And as you'll see, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the exemption from RCA authority over the renewable energy generator when they sell to one or more utilities that are regulated by the commission. That's the goal of the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee regarding this.
All right, thank you, Mike. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none. Got a couple people online. Go to the agencies first. We've got, I think, Daniel Patrick O'Tierney online. Are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Okay, could you, are you there for testimony or for questions?
I'm here for questions, if there are some, and I was just made aware of the bill and talked to your or to Mr. Pawlowski about the bill this morning, so I haven't done any independent analysis of it, but I've read it.
Could you just put yourself on the record so we know who's...
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Daniel Patrick O'Tierney. That's O'Tierney, O'Tierney, and I'm the Chief Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law, responsible for the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section, which I supervise, and my section performs the Attorney General's public advocacy role in regulatory matters under AS 4423-020E as an eagle.
Great. Questions for Mr. O'Tierney? Let me ask you, do you have any experience with this sort of indirect regulation of power producers or energy suppliers through the RCA's review of contracts?
By indirect, I assume that you mean that this poses no direct regulation of on a cost basis of an IPP, but that the IPP's provision of power would be submitted in a contract form with the utility to the commission for approval. So in that sense, the commission would engage the contract at that point in the process. If that's what you mean by indirect regulation, I have some experience with it.
Well, and tell me if this is a correct analogy or an incorrect analogy. I know that, for instance, when NSTAR purchases gas from a Cook Inlet provider, there's always this dispute that evolves regarding whether or not the RCA can look at the costs of getting that gas to NSTAR, for instance. Would that be a similar analogy, or is this something different they're trying to do in this bill?
Well, I think it's similar in the sense that direct regulation would be focused upon on a cost basis for the purposes of determining a revenue requirement and related rate base return that yields rates in a regulated environment. When a contract is submitted to the commission for its review, and of course I would defer to the commission and its chairman if he's still on the line in any kind of detail, but from my perspective and practicing before the commission is still applying the its just and reasonable standard to its review of the contract, but it doesn't have the capability of scrutinizing the costs involved in providing the service or the gas, or in this case, the electricity, the power. So it's then faced with having one party to a contract before it, submitting a contract, and the other party to the contract is not jurisdictional. So, and it's the party that produced the power and has presumably the related costs, you know, in the producing of it, that normally can't be is not reviewed by the commission. I think it's been a difficult situation from time to time, but I would leave it to the commission to speak to how it's dealt with the difficulties in review of contracts in that, you know, under the standard.
And from your position as in regulatory affairs and public advocacy, do you believe the public's interest can be adequately protected under this bill through the regulatory process, or I guess through this process of exempting independent power producers from regulation? Do you have any concerns over that, or are you okay with this?
Well, I guess I could respond to that in this way. I think any end user of a commodity or a product wants to have, you know, some assurance that the price it's paying is price disciplined in some fashion. In a capitalist economy, it's competition that normally provides that price discipline, and regulation is a proxy for marketplace price competition to the extent there is no market or there's not an effective market to do that job. So if I'm an end user and I would look at this proposal, I mean, that's the question I would be asking. Is there sufficient competition in the market that would produce independent power contracts for provisioning utilities that are either that are sufficiently market disciplined? If not, then I would probably have some concerns, and one would ask why we wouldn't be regulating that service.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. O'Tierney? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Anything else you want to add? Any other comments? Daniel?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. I really haven't spent enough time. I know the bill appears simple enough, but I haven't spent enough time with it to really say I did any due diligence. So I'm trying to respond to your questions, you know, best I can on that basis.
I appreciate that, and it's not our intent to move this bill. So I think the committee would appreciate an opinion, if you have one, on this over the next few days, pro con or simply or as simple as pro con, or if you have concerns that you believe we need to address with this, I think the committee would certainly benefit from that.
Well, I one thing I can say generally, just to add, and then I'll leave it there, is that, you know, you have to be able to compare apples to apples. So if markets outside involving IPPs are generally unregulated, you have to, I think, compare and contrast what our marketplace looks like for this service here in order to be able to determine whether, you know, that's a relevant factor in determining how to handle it in Alaska. I mean, that seems pretty basic to me. And I'm not the person to provide that kind of analysis, but there certainly are some who could, I'm sure.
Well, you're the person who's charged with protecting consumers for...
What I mean, though, is I'm not an expert on IPP status in outside jurisdictions.
I understand. And to the extent that you could, over the next few days, take a look at the bill and if you have any comments or suggestions for us, I think we'd certainly appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, we also have Bob Pickett from the RCA online. Are you there, Bob?
Chairman Wilikowski, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Bob Pickett. I'm chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Chairman Wilikowski, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be available for questions. one other issue in terms of an exemption of the IPPs from 4205 that hasn't been raised yet is this would also mean that they would not file for a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, or a CPCN. The CPCN does is it essentially makes findings that, one, this utility service is actually needed by the public at this particular location, point in time, so on and so forth, and that the financial, managerial, and operational capacities are there to provide the service that is applied for. I think a lot of good issues are coming to the table that need to be addressed, and I do applaud the sponsors of the bill for bringing this forward and getting these issues out there. Because in the arena of what FERC has called variable energy resources, a lot of issues have come to the forefront. And FERC, in fact, has issued a notice of inquiry about 3 weeks ago to address a lot of these issues. They want to promote renewable energy resources, but they want to do it in a way that does guarantee just and reasonable rates, but eliminates the impediments to these resources accessing the grid in the lower 48. Mr. Tierney brought up some very good points, and I think it's worth restating them. We have an island grid up here that is disconnected and for all practical purposes is not under the jurisdiction of the FERC. The FERC has taken market forces as a proxy for regulation in the lower 48, and they focus on, you know, the competitive wholesale electric markets. They continuously monitor these markets, and then they enforce market rules as needed, and they have a fairly well-established regime towards that effect. But they've also come to the conclusion that system reliability is critically important, and that's the purpose of this notice of inquiry that they have put forth. We understand the concerns about timing with a lot of these IPPs. IPPs by themselves, without significant public subsidy in some way, shape, or form, whether that be from the state, the federal government, direct subsidies or tax credits or whatever, will not, on a straight-up economic basis, pencil out and would not make sense, and it could not provide power at a competitive rate to the regulated utilities. We have had a case recently here, and I'll turn it over to James Keene, who actually deals with our CPCN application and approval process dealing with the small hydro project, Fishhook, that petitioned the commission for a strategy to address some of these. So, James, why don't you?
Yeah, this is James Keene. The last name is K-E-E-N. Just addressing this, the commission has last year released, I believe, two different orders exempting small independent power producers from certification on the basis that the commission would see these utilities come forward through the regulated utility they would be selling power to in a power purchase agreement. The commission would believe they could serve the public interest by simply looking at the power purchase agreement alone, regulating that rate to make sure a fair price is going and flowing through to the ultimate consumers, but removing the burden of certification and economic regulation from the independent power producer, and that was done in the case of Fishhook Renewable Energy, which is putting in a small run-of-the-river hydro in Hatcher's Pass, and then also South Fork Hydro in Eagle River. Both of those would be selling power to MEA.
And Chairman Wilikowski, this is Bob Pickett again. Another approach is the qualifying facility qualification under the FERC, in which if an independent power producer fills out the application, there's a self-certification track, but the state commissions will review those. And then there's a direct application to the FERC, and if the FERC does grant the QF status, essentially state jurisdiction is preempted. And then the QF will sell power to the regulated utilities at an avoided cost basis.
Thank you. Chairman Pickett, if a company is not directly regulated, does the RCA have access to information regarding power production costs when reviewing a contract between the IPP and regulated utility?
No.
And has this, I asked Mr. O'Tierney before about this issue regarding natural gas in Cook Inlet, and has that created issues for you in trying to set prices on natural gas in Cook Inlet?
Well, as anyone who has followed the Cook Inlet natural gas market for the last 7 or 8 years, it's obvious it has created some intense challenges and put us in a rather interesting position. Having said that, there have been several contracts recently approved, but part of it is going to depend upon how the case is presented, what interveners after the filing is noticed become parties, and the strength of the evidence presented and their arguments, and you know, everybody's due process rights are protected. So there is an uncertainty there for sure.
And I'm wondering if that's analogous in this situation with IPPs. My guess is they're probably typically much smaller than a situation like Cook Inlet, where you have large natural gas producers. Do you see that as being an issue? Do you have concerns over deregulating IPPs?
I'm not speaking for the commission. For the commission to adopt a formal policy on any particular piece of legislation or offer direct input, you know, that takes an action at a public meeting. But just speaking is from what I have seen in my time as a commissioner and chairman, yes, it does raise some question marks, particularly if timing is a big issue. It's going to depend on the nature of what the IPP brings in for both the interconnection agreement, which is another thing we really haven't talked about, but they're going to have to negotiate an interconnection agreement with the regulated utility, because price is not the only issue. System stability is very, very important. On the price side, they need to negotiate the power sale agreement with the utility. We're not in the middle of those negotiations. They're essentially presenting us from an agreement that they have arrived at arm's length transaction. And we'll be looking at the agreements as a whole for their reasonableness and whether we believe that they're in the public interest.
Other questions for Chairman Pickett? Yes, Senator Stedman.
Yes, if I could, Mr. Chairman. I just need a little bit of help understanding the effects on some of this renewable hydros if somebody was to come in and build a 20-megawatt or 50-megawatt hydro. Is it correct that they don't need a certificate of public necessity and convenience if this bill was to pass?
If this bill was to pass, our read is they would not require a CPCN.
So should I be concerned about that?
I will turn it over to Stuart Gehring from the Attorney General's office here. Senator Stedman, through the chair.
Chairman Wielichowski and Senator Stedman, this is Stuart Gehring, and again, I'm the Assistant Attorney General that represents the Regulatory Commission. And just to avoid any confusion, since Mr. O'Tierney is there, my role is found in AS 4204040A, which is the responsibility of the Attorney General to provide legal counsel to the Commission. So I'm speaking from the perspective of the Commission, not from the perspective of the Attorney General. And first of all, I would echo what Chairman Pickett said, and that is that our read of this statute as it's written now would be that the independent power producer would not be required to apply for or receive a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the commission, and it's, there are open questions, I think, about a number of other things, including the extent to which other requirements might apply, and particularly related to interconnection and so forth. And beyond that, I'm certainly willing to answer questions that you may have about specific details of what would apply in 4205 and what might not.
That answer your question, Senator?
No, not at all.
I thought I caught your question. I apologize through the chairman.
Well, is it something that I should be concerned about representing the general public
I will go out on a limb and say, yes, you probably should be. Whether or not ultimately as a policy matter you decide that there are other things that will provide a check for that. But the CPCN process is a gatekeeper function. For practical purposes, what that determines is two things. One is that what someone as an individual investor decides to build is something that the public actually needs. That's the public convenience and necessity part of it. The other part of it, the other aspect of it, is the fit, willing, and able part. Is the person who proposes to provide the service, which is needed by the public, capable of providing that on three distinct levels? Are they financially capable of doing it? Are they managerially capable of doing it? And are they operationally capable of doing it? And those are three. Those three things protect the public in from interruptions in utility service in the event that someone doesn't know what they're doing and is not able to actually follow through and provide the service under all conditions. Normally, if you contracting parties can agree with anybody to provide a service to them, and if that service isn't available at any given moment, there may be a breach of contract action, but the service is no longer available. And we, as a society, have come to expect public utilities to meet a higher standard, and that's to be essentially providing their services reliably 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the only way to do that is to put up a threshold across which the utility has to pass to be able to prove that they can do those things reliably. And so, yes, I would, speaking in direct answer to your question, yes, I would be concerned.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, we also, anything else from the RCA? I know we have several members there. Anything else?
No, this is Bob Pickett again. We will stay here and be available for any further questions.
Great, thank you. And we also have Ethan Schutt from Siri Online. Ethan, are you there?
Mr. Chair, this is Ethan Schutt.
Yeah, please go ahead and put yourself on the record, Ethan, and welcome to the committee.
Sure. I'm glad to be here. My name is Ethan Schutt. The last name is spelled S-C-H-U-T-T. I work here for Cook Inlet Region, Inc., or Siri.
Go right ahead. Were you here for questions or for testimony?
I understood I was largely here for questions. I guess I have some perspective about some of the things that have been talked about, so absent questions in front of that, I think I'd like to provide some context.
Yeah, why don't you go right ahead and do that?
Okay. Well, we've been working with some in the legislature to sponsor this bill that we think is important in making the regulatory fit amenable to the private development of renewable resources. For IPPs, while striking a balance to protect the public interest in the sense of making sure that the rate is fair and that the service is reasonable. As kind of a background for some of the status quo that you've heard from some of these, the RCA and the Department of Law, the background is that the status quo is we only have, effectively, we only have public utilities providing electrical service on the rail belt, and the CPCN and the rate case and all of those regulatory oversight functions that take place at the RCA are entirely appropriate given a public utility status, because if you think about the way the public utilities are established, they have areas where they have a monopoly service for electricity, and so to the degree they make good or bad business judgments or financial judgments or investments, or that they're operationally efficient or inefficient, the costs and benefits of all of that decision-making and function in providing electricity.
Ethan, can I just pause you? There's some kind of background noise there. I don't know if you're on speakerphone or maybe you can move a little closer to the mic. It seems to be a little bit of background noise there. It sounds a little better now. Oh, go ahead. Finish your testimony.
Sure. Apologize for not being there in person. It would be a little bit easier. But the bottom line is that the existing public utilities have a rate case. And so for better or for worse, their decision-making as it affects their cost structure gets passed through to their customers, and there's really nothing their customers can do about that. We're not proposing to be have a customer base where we have retail customers. Our particular focus is being developing a project and then having to go through a negotiated process, an arm's length process, to negotiate power sales through a PPA, power purchase agreement, with, in our case, almost certainly two or more of the existing public utilities in order to sell our power in a commercial to a commercial customer who happens to be a regulated utility. We envision as a part of that process that the utilities will demand a certain amount of information justifying our own costs into the project as a part of the cost side of the negotiation for that PPA, and that that same package of information that they use for their own purposes in the negotiation will actually also be used in making their case to the RCA why this contract is allowed to be put into their rate and their rate base as a part of their regulated function. So I know that the RCA staff and lawyers have testified that know that they won't have any ability to look at any costs, and I think, you know, from a strictly absolute interpretation, no, they can't. In this scenario, they wouldn't be able to call us up and say, you know, give us all your documents. We want to look at the invoice for rebar. That is absolutely true, but I think it's a little bit of misleading in the sense that these utilities aren't just going to buy power without being able to look at a certain amount of, including possibly some of them have already asked for everything, full so-called open books process. And so there will be a substantial amount of financial information and cost information in the hands of the utilities as they negotiate these contracts. I do also want to point out that in the notion of a market, when that word has come up several times in the prior answering questions testimony before mine, that the cost is not the only piece of the puzzle on the financial side. There remains a significant amount of risk that is allocated to the IPP side of the table that remains long after the contract has been entered into and is a function that is borne in almost entirely by the IPP. Some of the more significant risks that remain are, in the case of a wind project, the resource risk. In our case, we've got a long history of data from Fire Island, much longer than what is commercially used in many locations. It's 2 or 3 years. In our case, it's almost 10. But nevertheless, all that gives you is a better set of data to model a forward look about what the wind resource actually is. Now, if the IPP, in negotiating its price of power, gets that wrong, and that the wind resource is actually less than what the model indicates it should have been, that loss falls on the IPP side of the ledger, and there's no real way to, through a long-term contract, to allocate that risk any differently. We also maintain a long-term risk of equipment failure. We maintain and own the risk of cost overrun or other executional issues in the construction or the operation of the plant itself. So, you know, there are significant risks that are undertaken by the IPP and retained by the IPP during the development, the construction, and then ultimately the operation and the long-term operation of the plant itself. By contrast, if this was a project that was developed by a public utility, all of those risks are borne directly by the ratepayer, because to the degree the public utility got their resource model wrong, and the wind turned out to be not as good of a resource, they go back to the RCA and say, hey, listen, we've had a couple of years of bad wind, and, you know, if you look at our numbers here, we actually don't have as much wind as we thought we did. We're really sorry about that, but why don't you give us, you know, $20 a megawatt hour more in our rate base? We don't have that luxury. That's something we negotiate away as a part of the project and bringing the project online. We're happy with that, but we don't think that it's fair to cherry-pick the best of both worlds and treat us like a regulated utility through the contracting phase and in the scrubbing of the costs and the second-guessing of whether or not the rate is reasonable and all of the cost and complexity and time eaten up with a regulatory process in order that we can also then own all of the associated risks that we hold for the life of a project. We do believe that the current structure proposed by this particular SB 277 fairly allocates those risks and rewards for an IPP with a renewable resource when your only customers are regulated utilities.
Thank you for your testimony, Ethan. Any questions for Ethan? Okay, seeing none. Are there other people online wishing to testify? Okay, seeing none. Are there other people in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 277? Okay, seeing none. We'll leave public testimony open. We have a request in for testimony from Mr. O'Tierney, a review of the statute, and also if the RCA has specific concerns other than those that you've addressed, please don't hesitate to pass those on. Any other questions or comments by the committee members? Okay, with that, we're adjourned.